This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. It might seem crazy to hear about today, but it wasn't that long ago when the nation was under the grip of a spell. It was called a witch hunt led by Senator Joe McCarthy, a Wisconsin Republican. He said he had a list of communist infiltrators in the nation's capital, in the federal government. Texas was also under that same spell, the spell of the Red Scare. It ensnared the web of paranoia and baseless attacks was a Texas entertainer, John Henry Falk, along with educators in the state and others. Don Carlton wrote about it in his book, Red Scare, Right-Wing Hysteria, 50s Fanaticism and Their Legacy in Texas. The book is being re-released by the University of Texas Press. Don Carlton is also the executive director of the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History at UT Austin. And Don, welcome to The Source.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, Don, Red Scare, this is not a new book. This book came out a while ago.
It did. It had a long gestation period as well. But yes, it was published in 1986.
And here it is being re-released. And I think it speaks to today. There's a lot in here that is fascinating.
Well, this is the reason I was very surprised, actually, when the University of Texas Press made a decision totally independent of me, of course, because I had no idea they were even thinking about this, but they made a decision to release it. And my understanding from what I've heard is that they saw some parallels with politics today and the general political situation in the country.
Yeah, so we're going to get into all of that. So you chronicle mainly in Houston what happened with the Red Scare in the 1950s, and you tell the story of one individual, an educator. Talk about him.
Well, I think the thing I want to say first really is the reason I focused on Houston. I think it's important to understand most of the literature, most of the histories of the time. Before I wrote this book, really concentrated on communism, the whole McCarthyism in Congress and in Hollywood and labor unions is kind of a national thing. And what I was trying to do was determine if that seeped down to the local grassroots level as sort of a, Red Scare on Main Street. And to my surprise, actually, the more I dug in Houston, the more I realized I wanted to use Houston is kind of a test case. I was living in Houston, and I had run into a few things that had kind of hinted at this. And so that's the reason I focused on the local level, because the mass media and the sort of the popular conception of the Red Scare at that time was that it was strictly something that went on in Washington and Hollywood and really didn't touch anybody else's lives. It was just an elite phenomenon, and it just isn't true. And I think my book proved that beyond a doubt. And I went on and also went beyond Houston. There was a general Red Scare in Texas. It's mainly an urban phenomenon, San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely took place in all of the major metropolitan cities. But you do focus on this one incident in Houston with the educator.
Right, and the reason for that is because the Red Scare in Houston was really focused on the public schools. And I used an example, a case study of a deputy superintendent by the name of George Eby, E-B-U-I. And Eby was not a Texan, which was part of the problem. He was brought in from, he came from Oregon. He was actually a native of California. And he was a veteran of World War II, and he came in to a school district to be deputy superintendent. And this school district was in the middle of really a pretty bad Red Scare situation. A lot of it fueled, frankly, by racism and the fear that schools were going to be racially integrated at some point. This is before the Brown versus the Board of Education a decision, but that was still a great fear. And he really was a victim of and pretty innocent of doing anything. He came in as this outsider into this community to be deputy superintendent, and he was his background was looked into by these groups that were really perpetuating the Red Scare in Houston. And they found out that lo and behold, this guy was a liberal Democrat, and that just pushed them over the edge, and so they equated being a liberal Democrat and anyone that was supportive of Franklin Roosevelt or the New Deal or Harry Truman as being clearly communists. So that's pretty much what they accused him of. And they, the Houston Independent School District spent a lot of money doing a big investigation of this guy. And he was nothing but just a basic moderate liberal Democrat, frankly. They did spend a lot of money investigating him, hired private detectives, and there's a big, huge city scandals in all the newspapers. And at the very end of the investigation, they determined that he was clean as a whistle. He had, was not a subversive, had never belonged to a communist front or anything else, but they still fired him. And they fired him, the school board fired him, because for the crime of, quote-unquote, being controversial. Well, he was controversial because of these false accusations that had been made against him. So it was just a crazy time.
Right. And that trial, just some sort of publicity trial of E.B. was covered in Time magazine. It was in all the newspapers, became a national.
Yeah, it became a national story. It was so crazy, frankly. And some of the national media, like Newsweek and Time, and some of the national newspapers, kind of used it as a good example of some sort of the looniness that was going on at the local level, in the middle of this whole McCarthyism Red Scare thing.
But the McCarthyism and Red Scare, it took place in the 1950s. There was a lot going on at that time. We had the Alger Hiss controversy, his conviction. We had the communist, the Cold War, Russia had the bomb now. People were frightened.
Well, they were. And it was a time of great rapid, very rapid change. People are not at their best. Or when I say people, I should say, societies and culture that are undergoing a tremendous rapid change, when from one kind of world to another, in essence, the country was a completely different country after World War II than it had been before World War II, and there's no question that in times of rapid change, and this is not just in our society, it's really kind of a classic human condition. People have a difficult time. Most people have a difficult time dealing with change, and so their reaction, their bad reaction to change, unfortunately, often manifests itself in pretty negative and dangerous ways, and creates a lot of social upheaval.
Okay, we're going to continue talking about Red Scare, right-wing hysteria that happened in Texas in the 1950s. Don Carlton is with us. He wrote the book. When we come back, we're going to talk about John Henry Falk and what happened to him. We invite your calls and emails. Our number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back.
America in the 1950s, the time of McCarthyism, when an unsubstantiated charge that a man was a communist meant that a CBS broadcaster could be driven off the air, deprived of his right to earn a living, even to live.
One man, John Henry Falk, fought back against the same climate of fear which had caused teachers to be fired from schools, ministers from their churches, government workers from their jobs. Against that fear, which for 10 long years had turned American against American.
And that is the actor George C. Scott, and he is doing a setup for a film called Fear on Trial, which is based on the book written, Fear on Trial, by John Henry Falk. And John Henry Falk writes the foreword for your book, Don Carlton. I mean, we're talking to Don Carlton about his book, Red Scare, Right-Wing Hysteria and Anti-Communism Fervor that took over Texas and the United States during that time. So tell us about John Henry Falk. A lot of people have forgotten him.
Well, John Henry Falk was a folklorist. He was an entertainer, a humorist, a political activist. And it was the political activist part of John Henry that was targeted. His background as a political activist that targeted him, made him a target of McCarthyite groups. But really, and this is really kind of the essence of the Red Scare, we have to remember that people who were accused – were, you know, of being subversive. Many of the people who were being who were accused of being subversive by these McCarthy groups, these Red Scare groups, oftentimes whoever was making the accusation had something personal against the person, or was a political competitor of theirs, or an economic competitor. I mean, this was true even back in the Salem witchcraft days. It was petty jealousies and envy and rivalries and so forth. Well, even with John Henry, John Henry was trying to win office in the union that represents entertainers, radio entertainers, television entertainers. And his opponents basically drudged out all these charges that he was a communist and so forth. And he was not a communist. He was a very liberal progressive. He had supported left-wing groups. But, again, people get confused. Just because you are, say that you have political sympathies that are to the left does not mean that you're a communist. And at any rate, he was accused of being a communist, and no one ever proved anything that he was, and to this day, no one's proven that he was ever a communist.
But he was blacklisted, right?
He was blacklisted. There was an entertainment industry blacklist. It was mainly operative on television, so the networks, the three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS, were in those days very, 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 very vulnerable to their advertisers, because in those days in the 50s in television, nearly every television program except the news was sold by an advertiser. If you produced a television show, it was really up to the producers to go out and find an advertiser to sponsor them, and so the programs themselves were much more dependent on a single sponsor. So at any rate, the people that were involved in the McCarthyism learned very quickly that these big sponsors were very, very, like Ford Motor Company, let's say, or GM, or that kind of size, Monsanto, GE, or whatever, were very vulnerable to or were very frightened by boycotts of their goods by consumers. So anyway, they learned very quickly that they could put out these lists of people that they didn't like, and I'm talking about the Red Scare people who put these lists out. And if you wound up on one of these lists for whatever reason, and by the way, very few communists ever made these lists, frankly, then the networks just basically wouldn't hire you. You were off the air. That was it.
And so he challenged that. He actually charged someone with libel.
He was actually one of the few to actually fight to and you know, there were others who fought back against the blacklist, but John Henry was able to convince or persuade a very famous trial lawyer by the name of Louis Neiser, who was really at the top of his game at that point, and he was a New York lawyer. He was a celebrity lawyer. But he was a highly effective trial room lawyer and courtroom lawyer. And he took John Henry's case. And essentially what they had to prove, that first of all, you have to understand, the networks always denied that anybody was on a blacklist. They denied that it existed. So what John Henry's lawyer had to do was prove that there was a blacklist, and that's what he was able to do. He proved there was a blacklist, and that John Henry had been blacklisted and won the case. Unfortunately, the jury in the case awarded John Henry a very large settlement.
It was like it was a record breaker settlement at the time, with $3 million.
It was, but the other side of the people who were being sued, Aware Incorporated, which was kind of a grassroots organization.
It was called Aware.
They were bankrupt. They didn't have any money.
The group was called Aware, and they had no money.
Aware Incorporated, yeah. And it was basically funded by a guy who owned a grocery food chain.
But we're kind of getting away from the main point here is that that John Henry Falk, he was a well-known, established folklorist. He'd be on the radio telling funny stories, a la kind of like Will Rogers type of a guy, or maybe even sort of like Garrison Keillor.
Yeah, Will Rogers is a good comparison.
And so he's told, and he fights back, and he writes the book Fear and Trial, and he's able to establish himself as like the anecdote sort of to McCarthyism, fighting back.
Exactly. The irony is CBS, the very network that blacklisted him, turned around and made a movie about it and made a lot of money off of it. That's sort of the irony. But anyway.
So, and he writes a foreword to your book. Tell me about that experience.
Well, I became friends with John Henry several years before he wrote the foreword to the book, and mainly because of my work and as a historian studying this whole era and this whole phenomenon. And that's how I got to know John Henry, and because I certainly was very well aware of his case. And we got to be good friends, and when I finished Red Scare and was getting ready to publish it, I asked him to write the foreword, and he was pleased to do that, and I was honored that he did.
And he makes the point, because you write it in 1985, 86, it comes out, about bringing out how relevant these issues continue to be at that time.
Exactly, and that's exactly true. And you know, I think that touches on a point. I think that's important for people to understand that this sort of thing sort of simmers beneath the surface of American culture and society, has always been there. It never goes away. It's like, you know, having malaria. You can carry it in your body, and then all of a sudden you have a fever for a few weeks, you know, an episode. Well, it's this kind of thing is kind of endemic to American history. We've had it ever since
Right, which is why we can't afford to forget the lessons of the Red Scare.
Well, yes, because they're universal, frankly, and the lessons are you should always make people prove if they're accusing somebody of something, they need to have evidence and proof. And people shouldn't just believe these accusations just because of whoever it is that's making the accusation.
But also using the cover of patriotism to use to make attacks, take away civil liberties.
Well, that's always been the MO of these groups, going all the way back to the founding fathers, and that is, I'm more patriotic than you are, and patriotism has been a very easy thing to manipulate politically. Frankly, and demagoguery goes, hand in glove with this, because it's just, it's, as I say, we've had these episodes throughout our history, and so that's why in the mid-1980s, John Henry, again, was talking about it, because we were having the Contra Wars in Central America, we had the Nicaraguan Revolution. People don't remember this now, probably it's going on 30 years ago, but, people were literally thinking the commies, first of all, that the Sandinistas were all communists, which was not true, and, they were going to invade Texas or something. I mean,
right.
It was just kind of crazy, and that's what John Henry was writing about in the foreword, that, this stuff hasn't really gone away.
Our phone lines are open. We'd like to hear from our callers. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Do you think the Red Scare, could it come back? Or do you
feel... Well, not the Red Scare.
Not the Red Scare, but just that method.
Yeah. Well, it's not ever gone away. I mean, again, it's like having malaria,
But coming to a point where it's paralyzing the country and people, good people, are lose their jobs and are being humiliated and disgraced for basically nothing.
Well, I would argue that many of the attacks on President Obama are very similar, frankly, to what went on in the Red Scare. I think that they're there are so many unsubstantiated charges against his presidency and against, the people around him and so forth. And there are a lot of similarities there, I think. And I think there are a lot of similarities between the sort of grassroots organizations that really were the foot soldiers of the Red Scare, groups like the Minute Women in the 1950s. I think there's some similarities to them and some of the Tea Party folks.
How so?
Well, they have some of the same. First of all, they're grassroots organizations. These organizations, the Minutewomen, for example, which was formed in 1951, as they say, their motto was to defend the land they love. And what they were defending it against was racial integration. They were defending it against labor unions, against the United Nations, against subversive textbooks, against evolution, teaching evolution. I mean, these red button topics, issues, have a long life, frankly. They were very interested, the Minutewomen were very interested in censoring textbooks in the schools. They were successful in doing that, in fact, attacking some of the very same things that you see organizations in the United States attacking in textbooks as well. So there are just a lot of parallel issues. Anti-tax, the Minutewomen were totally anti-tax. Many of the positions that the Minutewomen and other organizations, that were involved in the Red Scare had the same issues that we hear today in the Tea Party.
And we're going to talk about that. I got to take a quick break. We're going to take a break. We've got to go to this NPR news break. We're going to talk more about the Red Scare, about the setup for that, the actual communists that were in Texas that were driven out, and some things that happened in San Antonio that many people may not be aware of. That were pretty amazing. We're going to talk about all those things. And also, we're going to take these calls. I've got callers piled up here, which I haven't been able to take. But we're talking about the book Red Scare, Right-Wing Hysteria, 50s Fanaticism, and Their Legacy in Texas with Don Carlton. He has written this, and this is the source on KSTX, and we'll be back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation with Don Carlton. He is the author of the book Red Scare, Right-Wing Hysteria, 50s Fanaticism, and Their Legacy in Texas, talking about a time in Texas and the United States when we were gripped with this anti-communism hysteria. And let's get some of our callers in on this. And our lines are open. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Do you think that something like a Red Scare could come back into the United States? And let's get George on the line. George, welcome to The Source. Thanks for holding on. Go ahead.
I've got a question about the different types of communism. I understand like Trotsky communism got foothold in Mexico, and then you had the Cuban communism. And what kind of communists? Where Mayor Castro's family understand that his mother and I guess relatives were active in the communist groups. I don't think they belonged to the Communist Party, but I think they were in communist groups. And I understand like the neoconservatives are supposed to be based on the Trotsky type communism. It's kind of all confusing to me.
All right, George.
Well, there's a good reason.
Thanks for that question. Go ahead, Don.
Well, there's a good reason why it's confusing, because I think that we make the mistake of thinking that people who call themselves communists are all ideologically driven, that they have some sort of really tightly woven ideological framework that they, some worldview that they have in common, when I think the experience has been that most of the controversy and conflicts and factions in communism are really all driven by personalities and egos and competition. So, Stalin wanted to take power in the Soviet Union, and he didn't want Trotsky to. Trotsky wanted to, and Stalin didn't. It boils down to age-old human rivalries, and I think that, that's part of the confusion. I think communism is not, I don't think it's necessarily the differences in how they view the ideology or anything else. It's personalities and the desire for power, and in their case, it's total power.
Right, and I think we should address the issue of like the claim that the Castro family was involved in communism. That's certainly not the case. The Castro, their mother was involved in trying to.
We're talking about the San Antonio Castros.
That was the allegation.
You were talking about the Cuban.
No. Well, maybe, but no.
I was assuming he was talking about Trotsky and he was talking. I thought he was talking about Fidel and Raul and those Castros, because certainly Surely he wasn't talking about the San Antonio Castros. I hope not, because that would be a total false. Anyway, maybe I misunderstood.
Okay, let's move on. Let's get Rob on the line. Rob, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing? Interesting topic today. I'm curious to know, I kind of pointed out, noticed a bit of an irony in that in drawing the comparison between the 50s hysteria against communism, as you'll call it, and then comparing it to the modern-day Tea Party, don't you think that that's kind of the same behavior, trying to paint them all with too broad a brush without actually debating?
Well, I want to clarify something. First of all, when you talk about the Red Scare groups had more cohesion than the Tea Party. There are lots of different versions of the Tea Party. So I think you get on very thin ice when you start making these kind of comparisons and contrasts, and I'm reluctant to do that. I was trying, because there's all kinds of people in the Tea Party movement. I know people well who are in the Tea Party who don't agree with many of the other things that other people in the Tea Party are in favor of. You know, so it's not really a cohesive, really, you know, homogenous organization, or even an organization as far as that goes. It's many groups. But so I agree with you that you're on thin ice when a person is on thin ice when you're making these kind of contrasts and comparisons. And so I want to clarify that. What I was trying to say is that many of the issues that many of the people who call themselves self-identify as Tea Party people share the same views as those people who were, you know, involved in the Red Scare. I mean, there's a lot of commonality is what I'm saying. And, yeah, of course there are differences. And you know, that was then and this is now. That's another thing. Historians are, as a historian, you have to emphasize that no particular time and place is exactly like the time before or the time after.
But there is a thread that seems to connect them, the common issues, but you know.
There's a whole list of issues that drove the Red Scare that are still very much with us today and are largely associated with people who identify themselves as being involved in the Tea Party.
And you look at the definition of McCarthyism, it talks about the use of reckless and unsubstantiated attacks on people, and it was took hold of the United States until McCarthy was, humiliated on national TV, and then Eisenhower declared.
Well, he humiliated himself, I want to say, but go ahead.
Yeah, and McCarthy and Eisenhower called him McCarthyism. It was no longer part of the national conversation.
Well, that's true, but it also proves that, frankly, that McCarthyism was sustained and encouraged for political reasons by a political party that had been out of power way too long, and I'm talking about the Republican Party. They had the shock of losing the election in 1948, running on regular issues, very rational issues, very good arguments and so forth, and they still lost to Truman in 48, Dewey did, and that is when McCarthy and people like him realized that they needed to grab a hold of another, really a scare tactic, to try to win the next election. And once Eisenhower was elected, then it was downhill for McCarthyism and the Red Scare. And they basically had, the Red Scare basically had the plug pulled out from under, the carpet pulled out from under them once the Republicans took power again, took back the White House. And, I think, for example, a lot of the Tea Party stuff, I mean, if, when Obama leaves office, I mean, we're quite, I think, possible that we're going to see a sea change in really the viability of the Tea Party. But, who knows? Historians can't predict the future any more than anybody else can.
Well, Edward R. Murrow said about Joe McCarthy at the end of his famous program on this See It Now, where he did an expose on him, that McCarthy didn't create the situation. He merely exploited it and to great effect, successfully.
I would agree with that as a historian. I think he was absolutely correct. I think the evidence sustains that.
But, here in Texas, this took hold on a very local level. You talk about in your book and about here in San Antonio, about there was a raid of a person's home, John W. Stanford Jr., who was a private bookseller, and they raided his house because he was selling books that they didn't like.
Well, yeah, books like, you know, were written by people like Karl Marx and Leon Trotsky, and even non-communists that were perhaps too far on the left or whatever. And, he was harassed and had his store raided. And he, John Stanford only recently died in San Antonio just a few months ago.
I wish I had known that before. That would have been
still had a little bookstore, in fact.
And then Mari Maverick defended him in court.
Exactly. Mari, who comes from, to coin a phrase, a whole long line of Mavericks, Mari Maverick Jr. is who we're talking about.
Yeah.
The late Mari Maverick Jr., whose father was mayor of San Antonio, famous mayor of San Antonio.
We'll talk about all that. We got to take a quick break. We're talking about the Red Scare and its legacy in Texas. We invite your calls, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX.
If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
And that is a newsreel or a propaganda film from the 1950s telling people to look out for communists. We're talking with Don Carlton. He has written the book Red Scare, Right-Wing Hysteria, 50s Fanaticism, and Their Legacy in Texas. So, Don, there was a lot of media support for this Red Scare.
Well, it was driven, frankly, by the press. We have to remember, it's hard to today, but newspapers were the most powerful public opinion medium in existence. It was much more powerful even than radio. Television was just being born at the time, and everybody just about read a newspaper. They got a morning paper, afternoon paper, or they got both. And at any rate, the newspapers had far more influence over people's thinking than they do today. And the Red Scare thrived. Basically, the newspapers saw the Red Scare as a really great way to sell newspapers. And so they just sort of competed with one another, printing these scare stories about, commies under your bed, and, your kid's school teacher is obviously a secret communist because she voted for, Harry Truman. That sort of thing.
And these newspapers were generally locally owned and controlled by by a family.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And many times the newspapers not only were in it to sell newspapers, but they were also because the owners themselves had a political agenda that they were trying to further. That was a very important factor in spreading the Red Scare was the press.
And especially like Dallas Morning News, Houston Chronicle, those are way out front.
That's correct. Houston Post, absolutely.
Let's get John on the line. He's called in. Our phone line is 614-8980. John, welcome to The Source. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering if you could kind of perhaps explain the difference between Jacksonianism vs. McCarthyism, and furthermore, if you see Jacksonianism as being kind of driving force behind like Tea Party and other politics today, or really like return to McCarthyism.
Well, your connection, McCarthyism, and what was the thing you wanted?
Jacksonianism.
Oh, Jacksonianism. Oh, well, that's. Well, I'm not sure we've got enough time to get into that. Jacksonianism, the essence of Jacksonian, there was a lot to Andrew Jackson's, or I should say the philosophy around Andrew Jackson. I'm not so sure Andrew Jackson really was involved in the whole thing called Jacksonianism. But at any rate, I mean, the essence of Jacksonianism was what we call liberated capitalism. It was a really opposition to any, you know, the regulatory state at all. And it was to it was basically just free market capitalism. So, I mean, that's the direct opposite of communism, of course. But now, as far as McCarthyism, I'm you know, there was a lot of there was a lot of anti-immigrant. There was a nativist movement around the Jacksonian period that shares some similarities to the Red Scare, because the Red Scare was also anti-immigrant in many respects. But other than that, I mean, the Red Scare people who supported the Red Scare, of course, were eminently free enterprisers. But that doesn't mean everybody who was free enterprise was in the Red Scare. You know, that's.
But that may have been a driving force, and they may have used it to try and push that political point of view.
You know, the thing I think that's very important for your listeners to understand is that the issues that people in the Red Scare were concerned about, let's just say sex education, which was a big thing. They were against sex education, okay? There are perfectly rational, logical arguments to be made against sex education, no matter what your position may be. I mean, there are rational, you know, you can, moral issues, there's all kinds of things you can do. What we're talking about here is that is the process where people who disagree with you are all of a sudden categorized as being subhuman or unworthy of having rights, or you know, we're talking about extremism is what we're talking about. We're not talking about people who actually advocate these particular issues. It's how they advocate them. It's how they turn the people who don't agree with them into some sort of alien, you know, being of some sort.
Right.
And that's a very extremist kind of a thing. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about ruining someone's life because they may be in favor of sex education, as opposed to just everyone going, yes, well, I've got my point of view and you have yours, but you're still allowed to do your job or whatever, you know, live in my neighborhood, that sort of thing.
Okay, let's get Lane on the...
They weren't allowing that. They were trying, you know...
Okay.
People were getting fired for having an opinion different than other people.
All right, one more caller. Lane has called in. Lane, welcome to The Source. Go ahead.
Sure. I think the book Red Scare should be required reading for every single high school student in Texas. But the Texas Textbook Committee would probably, unfortunately, not approve that. But I would like to know what your guest thinks that John Henry Falk would say about the Edward Snowden controversy if he was alive today.
Lane, thanks for your call. Thanks for bringing John Henry Falk back into the conversation. Go ahead, Don.
Well, you know, you always hesitate. Johnny was a very good friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine. I always hesitate, even with good friends, to try to think for them or, you know, what they would have done or not done. But I think I knew John Henry well enough to think that he would probably be on, that he would be on Snowden's side. I think John Henry would take Snowden's point of view.
So back to the point you were making before, they created this label, communism, and they've supercharged it, made it so hot and radioactive so that whoever they threw it at, suddenly they were no longer able to be part of the conversation, and they were demonized, and they couldn't be reasoned. They had to be outcast. And
And
this was being used for all sorts of different issues, integration, civil liberties, civil rights, anti-immigration, and progressive issues like increase of the minimum wage, anything like that you don't like, you could call a communist, and boom, they were no longer valid.
Well, yeah, I mean, even let's say the United Nations, which, you know, still is an issue today. There are still extremist views about the United Nations that are bandied about. You know,
like the Agenda 21 theory that we hear all the time about.
Yeah, well, and, you know, the ludicrousness of this thing, you know, for example, in the 1950s, the Red Scare extremists were saying that the United Nations was actually a commie front, and the evidence they had for it being a commie front is that there were countries that belonged to it that had communist governments. Well, that made the United Nations immediately a commie front. I mean, forget that was a vast minority a small minority of the United Nations membership.
Well, they also pointed to Alger Hiss and his involvement with the development of the writing of the documents that founded the United Nations.
Well, yeah, Alger Hiss, for one thing's role was not that important or significant actually in the government. But of course, I mean, Alger Hiss, I believe the evidence points to the fact that Alger Hiss was probably a spy. I think he was an employee of Soviet spy services. As the evidence has come out over the years. But having said that, you know, there's maybe you can count on your fingers of your hand how many people were actually proven to be communists during the Red Scare, out of tens of thousands of loyal public employees, and most of them were still tarred with the same brush. And, you know, to be against the Red Scare is not to deny that there may have been that there's a communist here and there.
And that also brings up the other issue with Alger Hiss, because there was also this anti-homosexual part of this.
Yes, of course. Well, yeah, I mean, it was anti-gay. It was not talked about in those kinds of terms. It was mainly referred to as perversity, usually a pervert. Okay, you know, that this person was not only a communist, but he was a commie pervert, which was code word, you know, for being gay.
And so that was wrapped up in there as well. But it's interesting, as more information continues to come out about Alger Hiss, I'm just fascinated by the case. And, you know, the microfilm that they found hidden in the pumpkin, apparently that was nothing. There was nothing substantial there. But they did find documents during the breakdown of the Soviet Union that they may have substantiated that Alger Hiss was doing some work for them.
Right, I think so. And I still don't think that is a stunning find, to tell you the truth, because, again, we don't have enough time to get into the history of this, but there were some very loyal Americans who believed that communism had something to offer to the United States back in the depths of the Depression.
Sure, San Antonio with the pecan sheller strike and Emma Tanayuka.
Exactly. They most of them abandoned that view once they really
this has been the
communism, but most of them didn't understand what communism was.
Right. Yeah, that continues today. The people who make the accusations that so-and-so was a communist, they have no idea what that means.
Right, exactly. Oh, God, no. Oh, no. I mean, if you're for Social Security, I think there's some people who will call you a communist today.
All right. Well, the book is fascinating. It tells a detailed story of how the Red Scare took hold of Texas. Groups rose. They attacked educators and progressives and labor unions in the state of Texas. Don Carlton, thank you for coming on to The Source and walking us through it.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you for having me.
And this is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks so much for listening to us.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.